This is Kelly Blewett. My guest tonight is Michael Sims, who is the author of several acclaimed nonfiction books and also the editor of numerous anthologies of Victorian fiction, most recently the ghost story collection, The Phantom Coach. In his first few books, Sims wrote about nature, but also about how our imagination responds to it. In Darwin's Orchestra, an almanac of nature in history and the arts, Adam's Navel, a natural and cultural history of the human form, and Apollo's Fire, a day on Earth in nature and imagination. Then he adapted the National Geographic TV series In the Womb into a beautiful companion volume. His most recent books have been biographical narratives zooming in on the lives of people who wrote about nature. The Story of Charlotte's Web, E.B. White's Eccentric Life in Nature, and The Adventures of Henry Thoreau, A Young Man's Unlikely Journey to Walden Pond, are his two latest. Welcome, Michael.
Thank you.
Okay, so let's go ahead and start with your entry point. And you write that your book, which again is called The Adventures of Henry Thoreau, A Young Man's Unlikely Path to Walden Pond, that you were looking for Henry, the quirky and talented young man, but not for Thoreau, the established writer. And I wondered if you could elaborate what that means.
Sure. I think it was a key element for me in wanting to write the book is that the icon, Henry Thoreau, had been sort of dusted off and hauled out of the archives and set up in the museum so many times, and with good reason. I mean, he's a magnificent writer, that I felt a lot of times when reading things about him that I had lost the sense of him as a living, breathing, confused, busy human being that he really was. And so I wanted to look at him before he was known at all. My book ends halfway through the Walden years before he's published even his first book, the one about his brother and himself on the river. I wanted to conjure, if I possibly could, what the streets in Concord, Massachusetts looked like and sounded like. What was it like walking there at night? What did people eat and drink? What did Henry Thoreau's cabin smell like? What were people wearing? And so in doing that, it made it feel a little bit like a novel, or at moments like I was making a movie. One minute I was in charge of costuming and setting, and the next I was working out the cinematography. It was great fun.
Your story begins whenever Henry is in his early childhood and ends with him in his late 20s. I wondered if you could tell us a little bit about what Henry was like, and in particular, how his personality came out through what he chose to share in the Harvard yearbook.
Well, as you might imagine, Henry was a complicated character who did not get along well with everyone and was seen as very much a character at Harvard. And in the yearbook, he composed a brief autobiographical remark, as everyone was supposed to do. And in his, he mentions that Quincy, the president of Harvard, had said one branch more and you had been turned by entirely, you barely got in. And so there is Henry admitting that at first he had trouble even getting into Harvard. And then at the end, he says, basically, though bodily he has been at Harvard, heart and soul, I have been far away among the scenes of my boyhood. And so he implies, even at that point, while still at Harvard, that going to Harvard was a distraction and may not have contributed very much. And he continued that attitude over the years, implying that the place where he had learned to read French, German, Greek, and Latin, and where he had really learned to wrestle with ideas, had not been worth the effort.
That's right. And he does so by talking about nature. As he says, I should have been scouring the woods and exploring the lakes and streams. And a big part of this book is how nature inspired Thoreau's imagination. And I wondered if you could kind of talk about how nature inspired Henry.
I think that's what definitely drew me into it more than any other aspect, because he's very important in the history of civil liberties. He's very important as a writer. And of course, I mean, that's why we care about him, is because he wrote so magnificently well that even if you disagree with him or argue with him or whatever, you are aware that he was a very powerful person, powerful thinker and writer. But the part that always captures my imagination and that all of my previous books have been about is how human beings respond to nature. And one of the things about Henry, and I so much in his youth and early manhood that I wound up calling him Henry instead of Henry Thoreau in the book, but one of the things that caught my imagination about him was not only how he responded to nature on a deep level from childhood, because we have even some of his essays written when he was 11 and 12 years old. So we know all the way back some of his early passionate response. But besides that, it was that it changed so much over time. Because at first it was the symbolic, platonic, the transcendental view of nature represents the great God around us and behind us, and that every aspect of nature is symbolic in our mind and heart. And he moved a great deal away from that. And ultimately, the point where he disappoints Ralph Waldo Emerson in moving away from this transcendentalist view is the part where he becomes most interesting to me, because he then stops saying clouds are symbolic of this or that, or nature is the great this or that, and he looks specifically at a certain animal in front of him, mm-hmm. a woodchuck, a fish, and he wants to see that animal. And he becomes more scientific in the sense of factual and fact-based and evidence-based and using his own observation. But he has such a poetic sensibility, and he had such a classical education, that the combination meant no one else had ever written about nature that way before. It was so original and so powerful.
That's right. And I was talking to my husband about this book and how Henry would go out to Walden Pond with a rock and a rope and try to figure out the topography of the bottom of the pond in a systematic way. And that was just arresting to me. I had never thought of him participating in that kind of scientific activity, because he does seem like such a sort of poet.
That is a great moment for me, when he literally plumbs the depth of the pond that had been so symbolic to him. And in Walden, you can see how it's symbolic to him on one level and very much his everyday experience on the other. And I think you're right. That's a turning point when he begins to do that kind of thing. He did it a great deal later in his life. A lot of it, his more careful observation of nature, is after the period of my book. So I had fun sort of painting the roots of all that, how he began to move in this direction and what form it took, such as he decided, people kept saying Walden Pond was bottomless, and he would, by George, figure it out for himself. His measurements of the pond are still used. In fact, he paid so much careful attention that his observations about when plants bloom in the spring and the progression of them is being used right now in a series of very elaborate climate change studies. He's considered one of the most careful observers of the era.
And yet, in your book, he is so fully human. And this might be a great moment to just read a little snippet. I'm thinking of the ice skating party, where is it Henry and,
Emerson? Emerson and Hawthorne.
That's right.
Oh, yes. Well, ice skating was a very popular hobby then, and very few women did it, but most men did. And it was, to me, a great moment. In fact, just by chance, you picked what was, to me, the centerpiece of the book. It appears exactly in the middle of the book, but also it's the scene I was writing toward, because my research on that is what originally captured my imagination. I found it in Sophia Peabody Hawthorne's notebook, the wife of Nathaniel Hawthorne. With that little setup, I guess the paragraph is comprehensible by itself. One afternoon, Henry and Emerson joined Hawthorne for a skating party. Sophia watched from the window as they paraded by on the river. At home on the ice, from countless forays since childhood, Henry led the way with an energy and abandon that Sophia found both impressive and ungainly. As if suddenly ecstatic, he cavorted in what she soon described to a friend as dithyrambic dances and bacchic leaps. Second in line was Hawthorne, gliding across the surface with his usual solemn grace, appearing to Sophia's eyes like a Greek statue propelling itself. Then came Emerson, seeming half asleep, tilting forward at the waist until his top half was horizontal, as if he napped by reclining on the air itself. Soon, exhausted, Emerson came indoors to rest, joining Sophia by the window. He said that her husband reminded him of a tiger or a satyr whose energy might be the death of an ordinary mortal such as himself. He beamed a kind smile at her. Mr. Hawthorne is such an Ajax. Who can cope with him?
That's just a wonderful scene.
It captured everything for me. At that moment, so many books about Henry Thoreau seemed to me to have been written by fluorescent lights in archives. And this was some of the great figures of American literature and American history skating around and being silly on the ice. And Henry literally skating circles around them. Hawthorne, of course, solemn and dignified. Emerson not knowing what to do, but going, I'll just go along.
That's right. But benevolent.
Yes. And at that moment, Henry was alive to me in a different way. And I had already started a book proposal for something else. And I set it aside, and within a couple of days, I wrote 3,000 words in one day on this proposal because I suddenly knew what I wanted to do. He had always been important to me, but I hadn't seen my own way into things until I realized what you said when you opened the conversation. I wanted to write about Henry, not about Thora.
Well, I just want to ask one more question, and it's a little bit of a personal one. You've written several books about writers' relation to the natural world, and I'm thinking about this book, of course, but also your last book about E.B. White. And I wondered how writing these books changed your own view of nature.
Well, I'm working on some autobiographical stuff about nature. I've always kept a journal erratically about being outdoors. But it's always been not exactly the comfort, because nature, of course, is heartless and terrifying at the same time. But it resets me. And so getting to spend so much time with E.B. White and in my sort of natural history of him in my book, The Story of Charlotte's Web, and then with this, with Henry Thoreau, and while I was researching and writing this, our first son was born. He's 20 months old now. And so taking him outdoors and writing about Henry's childhood, all of these things together, they merged and made it new to me. And when my wife was pregnant in the midwife center at the hospital in Pittsburgh, there was a huge sign on the wall that was by Henry Thoreau, which I thought was a beautiful omen. It used to, a line from him, "Every child makes the world new again." And writing about him and his response to nature while becoming a father made the world new again for me.
Well, that's just a beautiful line to end on. Michael Sims, thank you so much for being my guest today.
Oh, thank you. It was fun.
My guest today has been Michael Sims, the author of The Adventures of Henry Thoreau, A Young Man's Unlikely Path to Walden Pond. For Around Cincinnati, I'm Kelly Blewett.